All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Communication, It's Art and Soul. So they tell a story about a man who goes to a doctor. And he's complaining that he doesn't feel so well. The doctor runs a battery of tests and tells him, look, you're in bad shape, no more smoking, no more red meat, no more fatty foods, and you have to exercise. And then the doctor gives this fellow a bill for $200. The man says, what's the bill for? The doctor says, that's the charge for my advice. And the man says, but who's taking your advice? Who's taking your advice? So a lot of people give advice. And a lot of people give us advice. We give a lot of people advice. But we know, if we've been around, if we've lived, you know, any number of years, we know that it's not easy to give advice. It's not easy to take advice. Well, maybe it's easier to give advice, but when I say give advice, it's not easy. I mean, it's not easy to give advice that's taken. So last week we spoke about how to talk so that others will listen. Tonight, the topic is a little bit different and a little bit more personal. It's not just how to talk so people will listen, but how to critique, how to correct, how to advise so that others will be influenced. It's one thing for someone to listen to you. It's another for a person's life to be changed because of you. That's a much taller order. So tonight we speak about the art of influence. What causes people to accept influence and what causes people to reject someone else's influence on them? We'll explore some brilliant Torah teachings that explain the art of influence and mentorship, and we'll learn practical tools, very practical and real tools, for giving advice in a way that's accepted and internalized by the other. So if you've ever wanted to help someone, if you've ever felt the need to help someone, but you were concerned or maybe you didn't know exactly how to say it so that they would accept it and internalize it, this class tonight is just for you. We start like we do each week with our lesson video. In this video, you'll see a tense conversation between a husband and a wife. The husband is attempting to correct something about his wife, to suggest a behavioral correction. As you might imagine, the way we do this each week is we present a video that does not work out well. So as you'll see in the video, this conversation does not end well for husband and wife. So as you watch the video, pay attention and ask yourself the following questions. Number one, what is going wrong? And number two, what could be done differently in this conversation? So tonight's class, leading words, how to use our words to lead others, to guide, to influence. And now we begin with our opening video.
Sarah and Benjamin are at a restaurant along with their friends, the Sides. The conversation flows freely, but one participant, Sarah, has gotten lost in her Facebook and is oblivious to the conversation. That is, until someone asks her a question and receives no response.
Sarah, are you still there?
Oh, this is so frustrating. I can't stand when this happens.
Hello, Sarah.
We've been trying to get your attention. We were discussing our neighbors, Kaylee and Mike. Do you know when they're moving to Arizona?
Oh, yes. They are moving in April. I didn't realize you guys knew Mike and Kaylee. How do you know them?
Their four-way conversation is happily restored, and Facebook is all but forgotten. But later on the way home, Benjamin feels he must address the issue.
You know, Sarah, I've been meaning to tell you this for a while. You've become addicted to Facebook. I mean, I come home at the end of the day and I watch Samuel trying to show you a picture he drew and you don't even notice it. The twins get into a fight and screech loud enough for the windows to shatter, but you don't hear a thing. I think you should make a no phone time zone that expires only once the kids are safely in bed.
Oh, come on. You're making it sound like it happens every day. I'm usually too busy with the kids to even touch my phone.
Why are you getting all defensive on me? I'm just trying to help you.
Perhaps if you'd help me with the kids instead of criticizing me over nothing, maybe that would help.
Uh-oh, a pleasant evening out has turned out rather sour with a damaged relationship. But don't worry, Benjamin is listening in on this lesson. The communication skills that we will acquire will allow him to rewind and start again with a far more appropriate and nuanced approach to influencing his wife in this particular matter.
You are always smooth on those lights. I'm sure it's... Hey, I'm just saying. It's good stuff. All right. I love how the British narrator guy goes, uh-oh. That's my favorite. I want that on a loop. I want that as my ringtone. Like, uh-oh. I don't know why I would want that as a ringtone. I find it so cool. Okay. So here's the question. I said, keep in mind two things. What went wrong? What could have been done differently? So what went wrong in this conversation? Specifically. Okay, what did he say? Get specific. He didn't memorize the video? What? What? No. Just what do you remember? What do you remember him saying? He said something about Facebook. Oh, addicted to Facebook. Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, he did say addicted. Okay, good, or not good, but it's good. Good that we're picking up on this stuff. What else? What else did he do that was probably not wise?
He didn't own his own feelings about it.
What do you mean? Explain.
In the conversation, he attacked her.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, you know, when I see you on Facebook at dinner, it makes me think that you're not paying attention. That makes me.
Got it. Okay. Do we think that his objective is a correct objective?
That what he told her to do was like unrealistic.
But is the objective a healthy objective? The idea of not being distracted by other things when we're taking care of the kids, is that a reasonable? It's valid, right? So I think it is valid, right? The question is like this: if you, and this is really tonight's class, if you have something valid, it's not valid. It's not like he feels that he would like something, you know, whatever it is, you know, that's debatable. This is something that he feels. Let's assume he feels strongly about. It's affecting him. It's affecting the kids. Affecting their friendship. Whatever it is, and he really feels like he wants to influence her to not be on Facebook at certain times. Not never on Facebook, but at certain times that are important. Let's assume that that is valid. How do you go about that? You know, sometimes you want to tell someone something, and maybe you even need to tell someone something because they need to hear a correction or a different perspective. But you say it, and they blow up, or they become defensive, they don't listen, they reject it, and it's like, oh, why did I bother? Like, or how do I get this point across to influence in a way that the other will take it in a positive way and actually not abide by it, no one's dictating, but actually kind of you know, integrate it and take it in. If we say that we always have to be wary, you know, somebody might just not take it well or blow up or become defensive, so just avoid it. And that means that we're never to influence anyone else, and we're never to have any even attempt to correct someone else's behavior. Not even correct, because that sounds judgmental also, but to in any way influence someone's behavior. But we know that that's certainly not ideal. Especially when we look at it from a Jewish perspective. So again, tonight's class is very important when it comes to conversations that we might consider to be difficult conversations, in that we're telling someone something about themselves that we strongly feel needs to be adjusted somewhat. So it's a difficult conversation, but sometimes it's a necessary conversation. Let's explore the tools. I passed around the handout before. Pass one more back, please, to Alan. Thank you. Pass around the handout before. This is a little bit of an outline of tonight's class, just so you have. Yeah, we pass around just so that you have kind of in front of you the outline of what are the five keys for influencing effectively. That's what we'll cover tonight, but we're not starting with number one yet. Before we do that, I want to share with you something that I think might be very eye-opening. And that is that using our communication, our speech, primarily probably through speech and you know, face-to-face conversation, using our speech to influence someone else is not something that is another thing that can be done with speech, but rather it is a primary element of speech and a primary objective of speech itself. Let me say that again. We might look at our ability to communicate as the ability to say anything and everything. We can talk about the weather, we can talk about politics, we can talk about, although maybe avoid politics, right? We could talk about, what did I mention? Weather, politics, sports. We can talk about, I don't know, whatever, any number of things. And we can also try to influence someone else and try to guide, influence, correct, whatever it is. The point here is that in Judaism, influencing someone else is not just another thing that we could speak about, but it's actually a primary thing that we ought to speak about. And I want to show you how cool this is. The Hebrew word for speech, the Hebrew word for speaking, sorry, for speech and communication, speaking is yedaber. It's right there up on the board, yedaber in the Hebrew. Here it is, on the right. Speech in Hebrew is yedaber. The word for leadership, one of the words for leadership in Hebrew is yadber. Yadber. If you notice, those letters are the same. It's only the vowelization that's different. One is yedaber and one is yadber. But it's very close. It's the same letters. One means speech and one means leadership. And there are verses that use Yad Ber for leadership, verses in Scripture that use those four letters to mean leadership. Likewise, in Aramaic, we have a similar concept. Let me pull this back again. Similar concept in Aramaic. And that is that Daber means to speak, and Dabar is a leader. Again, we see the correlation here between speech and leadership, or speaking and leader. What's the connection? Before I explain the connection, let me add one more twist to this. The Kabbalah teaches, Jewish mystical texts teach us, that Hebrew letters are not just another form of language, not just another set of characters that are used to communicate, but rather Hebrew is the original language of creation itself. If you look back at the Bible, in the book of Genesis, it says at the beginning, God created through speech. God said, let there be light, and there was light. The Kabbalists teach, and Judaism teaches, that the original language of creation, the original letters are Hebrew letters, which is why when you study a little bit, not only when you know, when you're able to identify the Hebrew letters, but when you really study the Hebrew letters, you realize that there's so much depth in the Hebrew. Every Hebrew letter has a numerical equivalent value. The shape of the letter is significant. And there's so many different layers of depth to the letters themselves. But here's what I want to point out. Kabbalah teaches, Jewish mysticism teaches, that the letters of a word in Hebrew actually are channels and conduits of the energy and life force of that thing. So it's almost like the pipeline of spiritual energy into that physical item, it's channeled through the shape of the Hebrew letters of that thing. Which is why, again, Kabbalah will explain this, the shape of the letters is being significant. If you map the shape of the letters, you can almost get a sense of the energy of those letters and of that thing that's being formed by those letters. So here's the bottom line. If two words share the same Hebrew letters, now, the pronunciation is a little bit different. The vowelization with the dots underneath it, in Hebrew, that creates the vowels. That's a little bit different. But if the core letters are the same, Yadber on the top, Yadber and Yedaber, And one means speech, one means leadership. What that tells us is that these two words, which are really the same Hebrew letters, these two words are innately, intrinsically, inherently connected. They are organically connected, and they reflect the same type of divine energy. So what does it mean for speech and leadership? It means like this. To lead, you have to be able to communicate effectively. If you want to lead someone, you have to know how to speak. If you can't communicate, you can't lead. That's point number one. And the opposite is also true. What does it mean to speak? It means to lead. It means to influence. True speech, truly speaking, the gift of speech that we have ought to be used for a positive purpose. Now, we're allowed to speak. Of course, you can speak about the weather, and you can speak about sports. Everyone knows, probably at this point, that I'm from Pittsburgh. So, of course, you can use your speech to speak about Pittsburgh sports teams. You can talk about the Steelers, and now the Penguins, and maybe the Pirates. I don't know. That's a very difficult conversation. But you can use your speech for anything. But what's it really intended for? It's really intended to lead. It's intended to influence. We are correlating leadership and influence. Because what does it really mean to be a leader? It means to influence others. So, in Hebrew, we see a clear correlation between speech and leadership. How do you lead? With communication. Why do we communicate? To lead and influence. So tonight's topic is not just another topic in the genre of communication. How to influence through speech, but it really speaks to one of the core purposes of speech itself. Why are we speaking? To influence. So if we're meant to influence through our words, we ought to know how to do it effectively and not get stuck in the car in a very tense conversation like the husband over there trying to speak with his wife. Make sense? The correlation between speech and leadership? Yes? Any questions on the Hebrew and the mystical concepts? Make sense? Yes? Okay. Good. Let's take a look at text number 5. This is an unbelievable text. You can find this text. You can find this text on page 164. Let me set this text up for a second. This comes from Rabbi Schneir Zalman of Liadi, who was the founder of the Chabad movement. He was born in 1745 and he passed away in 1812. And in one of his mystical works, his Kabbalistic works explaining the Torah, he explains the significance of the human being referred to in Jewish texts as the medaber, as the communicator. If you recall, in lesson 1, we spoke about the fact that the human being is defined by his or her ability to communicate, which means that communication is a very important part of being human. But if we say that communication is connected with leadership and influence, what that means is that a human being is meant to be an influencer and a leader. Take a look at text number 5. Marnie, please get us started at page 164. Text 5, yeah.
The human being is called medaber, an articulated being, which is related to the word yadber, in the verse, God brings nations under one leadership. The name medaber points to our calling to lead all of creation and to elevate all that we encounter through our service of God.
So the Rabbi Schneir Zalman of Liadi, who's known as the Alter Rebbe, he's speaking certainly in a spiritual context, but the general point that we can extract from this applies to everything, and that is that a human being who in Jewish thought is referred to as a midaber, what defines the human being? Not the mind, but the ability to communicate, and the ability to communicate is connected to leadership, to being a leader, and to being an influencer. What that means is that each of us, as human beings, as a medaber, you and I, we're all communicators. The calling, therefore, according to Judaism, is to use our language tools, to use our gift of communication and articulation to help someone else, to influence someone else, to guide someone else, and to correct someone else when necessary. So it's not something else that we can also do with our words, but it's really a core function or core purpose for our words themselves. Now, That's all by way of introduction. Sogosant. I need to interject for a moment that this Jewish notion that we are meant to use our words to help others, to correct others, to influence others, is very contrary to a lot of modern sensibility. Our culture in the United States is very much a live and let live culture. We live in a society that says, hey, don't bother me and I won't bother you. You know, you see me doing something you don't like, ignore it, and I'll do the same with you. How many of us really know our neighbors, even? We like to live our own lives nowadays, disconnected from others, right? We're doing our thing, you do your thing, and don't bother me. Live and let live. Okay, that's one approach. By the way, so if you see somebody doing something that maybe you think is not so correct, or you think that, you know, maybe they should do something differently, you want to influence them perhaps, your next thought might be, just given the society that we live in, your next thought might be, yeah, but why do I care? And is it my business anyway? I wouldn't want someone else correcting me. I might as well not correct someone else. I don't want influence. I'm not going to influence either. To such extent, this idea, this separation between us and others is so stark, is so extreme. In other words, the value in the United States today is personal autonomy and self-sovereignty. I have autonomy over myself and self-sovereignty. Don't tell me what to do. I won't tell you what to do. It's so extreme that, and it's reflected in a shocking U.S. law, and that is, many of us know this, that there is no obligation to save someone else's life. If you see someone's life in danger, you are under no obligation. Sorry?
Really? No.
Legit.
There's a law. It's like, I forgot the name of it.
Unless you're related by family or through very specific in very specific situations. An American law. An American law.
Good Samaritan law.
The what?
Good Samaritan law.
Good Samaritan law is the opposite. The Good Samaritan law, I'm glad you brought that up. The Good Samaritan law is the opposite, and it shows as to how far we go the other way. Let me explain. In the United States, if you see someone in peril, assuming that you're not their parent, right? So you're under no obligation to save their life. That's the way it is. And, or if you're a doctor and you know something about a patient, whatever. But outside of these exclusive, very specific relationships, you have no obligation to save someone else's life. We have a shocking case study, text number 2, which we'll read in a moment, about a bunch of Florida teenagers. This happened a few months ago, last summer, that saw a man drowning. They videoed it and uploaded it to YouTube, or they posted it on Facebook, and they're laughing at this guy drowning. They don't save him, and there's literally no law against it. There are no charges that can be filed against the teenagers because they didn't kill him, but they didn't do anything about it. But you can't get in trouble for that. So the Good Samaritan law goes the other way. Let's say you see somebody in harm's way and you decide, okay, you say, look, I don't have to. U.S. law does not mandate me to step in, but I want to step in anyway. I'm a mensch. I'm a good person. I feel for this person. Let me step in and try to save their life. And in the course of trying to save their life, you harm them or injure them, you can be sued. The Good Samaritan law is a law that's protecting the Good Samaritan from facing liability if anything goes awry. But there's still no obligation or mandate to get involved in the first place. Take a look. Let's read text number 2. You want to pass? Lolly, please read text number 2. This is from July 2017, just a few months ago, as published in the New York Times.
The video was shocking in Florida, where shocking videos seem like a genre.
That's a little dig against Florida right there, right? We have some Floridians amongst us. It's like, all right, continue, please.
A group of teenagers laughed and watched and recorded videos of a man struggled in the water of a pond. The man drowned and his body was not found for days. The 5 teenagers did nothing to help him, not even call 911. But after examining the video, the authorities said this week that they did not break the law. In the state of Florida, there is no law that requires a person to render aid or call to render aid to victims in distress. Yvonne Martinez, spokeswoman for the Cocoa Police Department, said on Friday...
So something very important about that line. In Florida, There is no law that requires a person to render aid or even to call to render aid. You don't even have to call 911. Look at that. That's shocking. It's not a Florida. Okay, the first paragraph was a little bit Florida bashing. This is not Florida bashing. This is the law in most states in the U.S. There's no federal law, certainly. And I don't know of any states that actually require you to step in. Continue, please.
Shows a man flailing in the middle of a body of water as the teenagers describe his struggle and laugh at him from the shore.
So that is the video. By the way, the prosecutors were considering, okay, so there's no law in the books that require these teenagers to help the man, but maybe they could still somehow file some charges against the teens by not reporting a death. There is a law in Florida that says you have to report a death. If you know of a death, you have to report it. They knew of this death, and the body was only discovered 5 days later. So maybe they could get them on that. But the core point here is that in the United States, in our society, it's all about personal autonomy, self-sovereignty. I'm not going to get mixed into your business. You don't get mixed into my business to such an extent that even if someone is in mortal danger, there's no obligation to help the other person. Now, I will tell you that Jewish law, many of you, we've had other courses that have focused on this idea very extensively. Jewish law is very, very different. Jewish law says that not only are you not allowed to, not only do you get a free pass to not do anything, but you have an obligation, you have an actual mitzvah obligation to do something about the person in danger. Lo sa'amod al dam riecha. The verse says, do not stand by your fellow's blood. If somebody is in mortal danger, you have to step in. You have to fix, you have to help, you have to influence, you have to guide, you have to do something to help them. Take a look at text number 3. David, please read this one, page 163. Maimonides describes this law.
A person who can save a fellow who is being threatened with murder but fails to do so is in violation of the injunction. Do not stand idly by the shedding of your fellow's blood. Similarly, one is in violation of do not stand idly by your fellow's blood when sees someone drowning at sea or being attacked by robbers or a wild animal and is in a position to save him or her or to hire others to do so, but refrain from assisting.
So Maimonides says, Rambam writes, that if you can save someone and you don't, you're in violation of Jewish law, violation of biblical law. So what we see here is that unlike our legal system and our society that says you don't need to get involved in what's going on with somebody else, Jewish law says if someone's in danger, if someone needs something, you have to be there for them. And it's not only cases of life and death. Judy, please read text number 4, where Maimonides extends this concept to helping someone else out spiritually. In other words, we have an obligation to actively reach out to someone else and help them in ways other than life or death. Text 4.
One should not say, I will act righteously, and if someone else chooses to stray from the path of righteousness, that is a matter that is between him and God. This attitude is inconsistent with Torah values. Rather, we are commanded to do the right thing ourselves and to see to it that others too conduct themselves appropriately.
And that's a broad statement. It is an obligation to not only do right, but to see to it that others do right as well. Now, obviously, the big question is, well, what if your definition of right is different than their definition of right? And that's a valid question, and there's no way to answer that very easily. But if we bring it back to our lives and our individual situations, there are always times that, not always, but there are often times where we see somebody doing something and we know that it's not the right way for them. Maybe we see somebody struggling with something and even they know it's not the right way and maybe they need some influence, some guidance, some help, some critique, some correction, and we might be able to help. Judaism says, Jewish law says, it's codified here in Mishneh Torah and Sefer HaMitzvot and these various works of Jewish law, and stemming from biblical law about not standing by your fellow's blood, what we see Judaism teaching us is that you can't sit back and say, look, it's not my problem. I've identified the issue, not my problem, I'm not getting involved. That's not okay, it's not kosher. If you see somebody that needs help and you have some guidance that you can offer, you have to be there for them. You have to help out. Which means that you have to know how to do it. Because if you reach out to try to help and the help fails, like the guy in the car, then what was the point? You didn't accomplish anything. Oh, now his wife is upset at him. She's not going to go on Facebook now. She's now just resents that conversation. She thinks her husband's, you know, I don't know, insert adjective here, whatever that is, right? She thinks her husband's, you know, not being nice by attacking her in the car on the way home from dinner. So the point is, number one, communication is tied into leadership and influence. It's part of what makes us human. Number two, we are responsible for each other. If you see somebody that needs help, be there for them. In other words, if we're going by slogans, so on one side of the position, like the Americans, the typical societal stance is live and let live. Judaism says, to borrow another societal phrase from the subway in New York City and from other places, if you see something, say something, right? You know that phrase, if you see something, say something? That's Judaism. Judaism, if you see something, say something. Don't be obnoxious about it. And don't, but when appropriate, if you see something and you have something to offer, say something, help correct. But you have to know how to do it. Because if you don't do it right, then don't do it at all. And that's what we're going to get to today. One more point. Question is, why does Judaism take such an involved position on this? Why does Judaism say that we have to get involved with others and influence them and guide them and lead them and help them and save their life if they're in danger? What's wrong with the live and let live motto? Like, is maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we should just live and let live. So here's the core idea. This goes back, this goes to a very, very spiritual, mystical, and a very powerful Jewish theme. And that is, Judaism teaches that essentially we are all one. This is really important. Even though our bodies are distinct, we look different, we speak different, we dress different. In other words, physically, we may be distinct. At our core, we are one. We all have a soul. We all have a divine soul, comes from the same origin. We all share collectively, generally speaking, the same mission, which is to make the world a better place. Right? So there's more of the deeper stuff that unites us than divides us, much more. Like we're divided by such relatively, like, and scale of importance, by such small things that are, distinguishes us from each other. But the big core things, we're united. So Judaism says, wait a second. You see somebody, you see your brother or your sister. You see somebody that's struggling. You see somebody, let's go with this simple example, drowning, God forbid, right? Your brother, your sister, not anyone here, right? But someone's brother or sister is drowning. You're not going to save them? Be like, oh, it's not my problem. It's not your problem, it's your family. You know, I mentioned before that U.S. law will say in certain situations, if it's a child, you can't ignore your child, right? It's your responsibility. So we can frame it this way. Judaism says, who's your family? Everybody's your family. That's the core idea. U.S. law says, no, there's family, you have to take care of your family, but otherwise, the stranger, the other person, you don't need to worry about them. Judaism says, we are family, right? We're family. We're all family. We're all one. Again, what divides us is so relatively insignificant in comparison to what unites us at our core. So at our core, we're united. We all have this spiritual core. We all have this godly core inside of us. So Judaism says, number one, you have to love your fellows yourself. Well, how do I love my fellows myself? Because you recognize that that you're one with them. They're one with you. Your brothers, your sisters. So of course, why wouldn't you love them as yourself? And if you love them, then you ought to influence them. You can't see someone drowning either literally or metaphorically struggling with something and doing something that is harmful to themselves or to others. You can't witness that and remain stoic and unmoved by it. You can't be like, well, it's not my business, not your business. What do you mean it's your brother or your sister? Of course you have to say something. But you have to say something in the right way. So We've established now already three things not on the list. These are all three preliminary things. Number one, speech and communication is intrinsically connected with leadership and influence. To be human is to influence, number one. Number two, whereas society may say, live and let live, Judaism says, if you see something, say something. And number three, why? Why should we get involved in someone else's business? Because they're not such someone else's. They're your brother and your sister. So why wouldn't you want the best for your brother and sister? And why wouldn't you say something if you can help improve things for them or help influence them in a positive way? Make sense? All of this is kind of the setup. Yes? Questions, comments, stories, anecdotes. Okay. So now that we've established that it's a mandate, a personal mandate incumbent upon each and every one of us to positively influence another person, other people. So let's look at the Torah tools, Jewish tools for doing so effectively. So here's the first thing we need to know. If we're trying to influence someone and it's not working, if we're speaking to someone and this is what you need to do, you're struggling with this, other people are struggling because you're doing this, and this is what you need to change. If the husband is telling his wife, the kids are missing you because you're absent when you're at home, because you're on your phone, and if that's an important message that needs to be conveyed, but it's not resonating with the other, and they're not taking in the influence in a healthy way, where does the problem lie? This is something we talked about last week also. If someone's not getting it, where does the problem lie? With you. With you. You're not doing it right. There's an unbelievable Talmudic passage that expresses this. Again, it's fabulous. Take a look. We're skipping a bunch of texts here. Take a look at text number 8. Text number 8. Reuben, you up to reading? Fantastic. Okay, so page 167, text number 8. Here we have two statements from different rabbis in the Talmud. And after we're done reading it, I want to connect the two together.
Rabbi Tachbarn said, I wonder if there is anyone in this generation who knows how to accept critique. For if one person chides another, the other responds, you are guilty or even greater indiscretion. So how dare you? Rabbi Yisbar ben Azari said, I wonder if there's anyone in this generation who knows how to properly give critique.
So, thank you. So the first rabbi says, he's like speaking out loud. I wonder if there's anyone in this generation that knows how to really accept criticism. You criticize someone, you critique them, or you advise them, and the next thing you know, how did you tell me this? What about you? And you, who do you think you are? Like, we tend to get defensive and then go on the offensive to attack the other person that's trying to correct. So Rabbi Tarfon is saying, is bemoaning the fact that no one knows how to really humbly and correctly take critique in a positive way. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, no, that's not the problem. The problem is not that people don't know how to take critique. I wonder, he says, if anyone in this generation knows how to give critique properly. That's the problem. The problem is not that people get defensive. He's trying to flip the narrative. Instead of blaming the people for getting defensive and not taking critique, and you can't tell anybody anything because everyone, you know, pushes back. That's not the problem. That is a problem, but it's not the problem. The core of the problem is that people don't know how to give critique. So we end up saying things that basically make the other person punch back. So again, the idea here today is to analyze, to discuss, to explore how we can properly, correctly give critique to someone else. Because we have to. It's our brother, it's our sister. And if they're not in a good place, we have to step in. But we have to do so in a way that allows them to accept a critique. And again, it's not just listening like we spoke last week. It's more than listening. It's being influenced. Influence is different. Influence means that you're not only going to listen to the idea and say, you know, I agree with it, but you're actually going to put it into practice and live by it. So that maybe you put away your phone or you turn it off at night at the dinner table, or when you're doing homework with the kids, whatever it is in that example, right? So maybe but it's about concrete actions, about being influenced to take action. So with this in mind, and now we're putting ourselves in the shoes not of the one who's being influenced, but the influencer. We're going to be the ones that are learning how to influence properly. So with all of this in mind, let's learn the five keys for effective influence. All right, let's see what we missed here in the PowerPoints before we start. Here is the drowning. Oh, wait, what happened to this? Look at that. Boom. Okay, so our projector will go back on soon. In the meantime, I'll look at the slides as they go by and make sure that we're not missing anything terribly important. So go back on when it's good and ready. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so the first key is, let's see if it comes up. When it comes up, it'll come up. The first key for effective influence is attitude. This is the first one on your sheet. First one says attitude equals love. This pretty much gives away what this point is. If we hope, here's the big idea. If we hope for the other person to take our influence to heart, so it must be coming from our heart. There's a famous Jewish saying, and I'll say it in the Hebrew first. Devarim hayotzim min halev, nechnasim el halev. Words that come from the heart enter the heart. If you want your words to enter into someone else's heart, they have to come from your heart. If you're telling them something, you know, you're just, you know, whatever it is, but it's not coming from the heart, then they're not going to feel it in their heart and it's not going to work. What does it mean that it's coming from your heart? The way we're specifically, the part of the heart that we're referring to is the emotion of love. So here's the big idea. If you want to influence someone and you want them to accept it in a gracious way, in the right way, it has to come from your heart, from a place of love, and it must be solely intended for the other's benefit. Effective influence cannot come from a place of anger, disappointment, fear, hostility, or judgment. Those are invalid reasons for or motives for influencing. It has to come from a place of love. Let's read this from the Torah source, from the biblical verse in Leviticus, text number 9. Terry, please read this one, page 168. So this is great. This comes from a series of verses in the book of Leviticus, where there's a bunch of different laws being stated in the Torah, and each verse is divided into two. There's the first half of the verse and the second half of the verse, and each verse, the two halves seem disconnected, right? So the first half of this verse is, do not hate your brother in your heart. All right, so don't have hate for someone else. Okay, that's one point. Don't hate. Great. The second half of the verse is, rebuke your fellow. Okay, don't hate, but rebuke, it seems like two separate laws, but of course they're connected. And what's the connection? When you rebuke your fellow, and rebuke here means criticize critique, to try to influence in a positive way. So when you rebuke, when you try to critique your fellow, make sure it's not come from a place of hatred. Because if it is come from a place of hatred, it will not work. That's the way it is. It will not work if it's coming from a place of hate. So, if you are angry, let's get back here. Hold on. Yeah. Okay. If we hope to positively influence someone else, it cannot come from anger, from judgment, from hostility. If that's the case, don't bother critiquing. It's not going to work. It's an illegitimate form of critique. Because you can't rebuke your fellow when you're nursing hatred for your brother in your heart. If you are disappointed, if you are resentful, let's just speak very frank. In that video, how was the husband feeling toward his wife in the car? Maybe disappointed. Maybe embarrassed. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Maybe he was embarrassed. You know, his friends, you know, they're trying to speak to his wife, and his wife is, you know, not even paying attention. It's embarrassing. Maybe he felt embarrassed. And now he feels like he has to say something. You know, he has to, it's not right. And he's the husband, he should really say something, right? Invalid. But what's wrong? She did something that he thinks is not correct. He can see it objectively because he and he's her husband, so he should be able to say something. So what's invalid? What is illegitimate about it? Because where is it coming from? It's not coming out of love for her. It's coming out of him feeling embarrassed, right? Disappointed, maybe angry, maybe resentful, whatever it is, whatever emotion is going on. If it's about him, it's illegitimate. It has to, for critique to be accepted, it has to come. The only way someone else is going to really take it take it to heart and integrate it and live with it and be influenced by it is if it's totally intended for the other out of love for them. If that's not where it's coming from, you're wasting your time. And not only are you wasting your time, it's going to backfire. It's going to blow up. It's not only when there's anger or hostility or negative feelings toward the other that it's that the critique or the influence is not going to be effective. Any motive that's about you and not them won't work. So for example, let me give other examples that I wrote up here in my notes. Your child did not clean her room. And now guests are coming over and you're embarrassed by the mess. And you want to you want to tell her off. You want to say, you know, you got to clean up the room. What's going on? That's about you. It's not valid. Now, I know what you're thinking. So what, parents can never tell their children to clean the room? Of course you can. And you can punish, and you can force them to clean the room, and that's that. You can do whatever you want. But you're not influencing your child. You're forcing your child to do a behavior. And there's a difference between the two. You're not teaching them. You're forcing them. You're threatening them. You're shaming them. You're embarrassing them. You're whatever it is, but you're not influencing. Influencing means that the person will take a lesson far beyond the moment. When do you influence? You influence from a place of love. First and foremost, from a place of love. If you care about them and you're doing it only out of love for them, they will sense it, they will take it, they will believe in it, that it's in their best interest. Otherwise, it's about you. You're telling me what you want. Okay, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't do it. Even if I do it, I'm not happy about it and I'm not going to do it again until you threaten me again or whatever it is. That's the way it works. That's the way human beings work. When you sense that the other person cares about you, then you're listening. When you sense that they care about themselves, wait, why do you want me to clean my room? Because you have people coming over and you're embarrassed that my room is messy? So I'm doing this for you? Whatever. You know how kids say whatever? Whatever. Right? Whatever. This is a whatever experience. You're not influencing the child. Now, how about this? You're in synagogue and the person next to you is talking during the service and disturbing you. You can't concentrate. And you want to tell them off, right? Shh. Quiet. Can't concentrate on the prayers. Seems like a valid thing to do, right? It's about you. It's not valid. You're not going to influence. You may get them quiet for the moment, but you're not going to influence them. Again, the key is you don't influence. You never influence by telling someone critique that has to do with you. That's not how... So your neighbor leaves the trash bins out 3 days after garbage collection, and it drives you bananas, right? Because you're the person that it goes out right before the garbage trucks come, and it comes back in right after they pick it up, and your neighbor, it leaves them out. And you don't like the look. You don't like the look of those blue and green bins on your street. And it drives you crazy, by the way. I'm not validating whether that's a good thing to get worked up by or not. But let's say that gets your goat, so to speak. right? And you feel that that's just plain wrong. It's wrong to leave the garbage cans out, and you can probably cite a city ordinance that also says something to that effect. So you believe that it's wrong, and you want to tell them off. Again, it's about you. It's not valid critique. Again, you can do whatever you want, and you can tell them, and maybe they'll listen, and maybe you know they'll do it. But you don't influence someone by telling by sharing your frustrations about what they're doing, or sharing how you feel about what they're doing. That's not how you influence. You influence from a place of love. Torah provides for us an amazing model, an amazing example of this, where critique coming from a place that's not about the other falls flat. And I'll give you the story. The story is about Noah. Noah and the great flood. Does anybody know how many years it took for Noah to build the ark? 120. Noah built the ark for 120 years. That's how you know he was Jewish. I've seen Jews in Home Depot. Many of them have no idea what to look for. I'm one of the. How do I know this? Because I'm one of those people. Howard, you would know what to do. I know this. Howard's in the business. He's in the building business. But like a guy like me, I walk in, I'm like, I need help. I need a whole help desk just to escort me through the thing, because I need one of these, one of those. I have no idea where to go. That's just my, that's my thing. Noah builds the ark. It takes him 120 years. Most people don't live 120 years. This guy's building an ark for 120 years. I want to ask you another question. How many people serve people? We had animals and fish and birds that survived. But how many people survived the great flood according to the Torah? How many people? So we have Noah and his wife. Noah's three sons and their wives. That's eight. Plus, there's a Midrashic tradition that the giant Og, the giant, I would call him the Jolly Green Giant, but that's not, I don't think he was. Og, the great giant, was holding on to the side of the ark, and he was also spared. He later on became an arch enemy of the Jewish people, but at that point he was righteous and he was also spared, but he couldn't fit into the ark. He was a giant after all, and the ark wasn't built for giants. So he had to hold on, kind of have some sort of safety, you know, attaching himself to the side of the ark, however that worked. Which means that how many people were saved in total? Nine. Later on in the biblical narrative, Abraham is told by God that God is going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and other cities like that. There were five cities in total. Abraham prays to God that God not destroy these cities. And he negotiates with God. If there are this number of righteous people, then save them. What's the lowest he goes before he backs off? Do you know? What's the lowest number of righteous people that he's asking God to see if there are, after which he says, okay, fine, so do your thing because I can't negotiate anymore. The lowest is 10. 10. A minion. 10 is a quorum in Judaism. It's a special number. It's like a whole number. One is also, I guess, but 10 is like the first unit of like a community, if you will. So Abraham says, if there's 10, save. And then once there aren't 10, he's like, okay. So he goes back and he lets God do his thing. What does this tell us? That if there's 10 righteous people, you can avert a decree of destruction. Wait a second. How many people were how many righteous people were there in Noah's times? How many people?
Nine.
One away from a minion. You understand what's going on here? One away from maybe saving the world. If they had 10, maybe God wouldn't have destroyed the world with a flood. How many years did Noah have to build the ark? How many years did he know about the impending flood that he could have influenced others? How many years did he have to get one more person on board? Literally, how many years? 120. He couldn't pull together a minion in 120 years. You understand this? The same nine people that were righteous at the beginning are the same nine people that he saved. Not one more person in 120 years? Talk about a guy with... Talk about a fellow who couldn't influence others. What went wrong? So in an amazing analysis, the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains that it's not that he didn't tell people about the flood and about the fact that they need to repent or return to God or else. He did say that. But he didn't care. He didn't care about them. He only critiqued and he only warned because God told him to tell the people. But he didn't really care about other people. He didn't. Text, let's read this inside. Sharna, please read text number 10, page 168. Notice how the Rebbe says, perhaps this is the reason why. Remember we talked about tentative using tentative language? The Rebbe doesn't say, this is why. No, I'm saying that because the Rebbe's perhaps is my, this is definitely it, right? But you see, again, a modeling, parenthetically from a previous class, a modeling tentative language. But look what the Rebbe is saying. The Rebbe is saying that the reason why Noah didn't bring anyone else on board is because even when he told people what to do, even when he used the words that might otherwise influence them, it didn't emanate from a place of love, care, and concern for the other. It was about him and his obligation. So he wasn't angry at the people. There's no indication here that he was angry at them or judgmental, but it's just he was discharging his duty. God told him to tell the people, he told the people. But he wasn't really in it for them. No, the point here is, people typically are not influenced by you telling them what you want to tell them. They're influenced when they sense that you love them. You love me, you care about me, and you think this is really for my best interest, now I'm listening. You tell me what you think is in your best interest because you have this obligation, because you need a clean house, because you want to pray, because you want a sidewalk devoid of green and blue bins. You're telling me what you want, whatever. You tell me, you share with me that you love me and you care about me and this is in my best interest, you have my attention. You see the difference? So, step number one for influence, and this is probably the most important one, which is why we start with it, is attitude. Check yourself. Where is it coming from? Do you care about the other person? Do you love them? In the moment, is this critique, adjustment, correction, influence, potentially influential words, are they coming from anything within you, or are they coming out totally for the sake of the other because of your love? Contrast Noah with Abraham. Our sages tell us that Abraham is the father of monotheism. Abraham, after a few decades of teaching about monotheism, about the one God, according to our sages, had tens of thousands of followers. Tens of thousands. Noah, in 120 years, had zero. He had zero likes on Facebook. I'm kidding. He had zero whatever it is. No one joined his club. Very lonely, crickets, you know, sounding club. Abraham, tens of thousands of followers in a short few decades. Why? Abraham loved the people. Abraham didn't tell people what to do or what he believed in because he felt like it was an obligation or because he was judging the other people, because he truly loved other people and he wanted to share with them something that he thought was great and would be great for them. When you tell somebody, oh my gosh, I just tried this new restaurant, it's amazing, you're going to love it. You know what the other person says? Tell me, maybe I'll go. Because you're telling them something that they want to hear. It's about them. It's, I like you. I had this great experience. This is great. I think you're going to love it. Here's what it is. How different is that from, you know, I was watching you before, and I think what you need to do is put away your phone because, I mean, that's a totally different message. First of all, one has to do with food and one has to do with Facebook, like putting away Facebook. So obviously it's different. But the point is, again, is it emanating from a place of love for the other? Then good. Then it's kosher. If not, not kosher. Second, make sense? Yes? Questions? Comments? Okay. Yes. In his generation, he was righteous. Exactly.
Yeah, but
in another generation, he wouldn't have been... Right, so what Marnine is saying, that the Torah says, Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav. Noah was a righteous man perfect in his generation. And our sages say, some sages say, what does it mean in his generation? It's telling us that relative to his generation, he was righteous. But relative to Abraham, he wasn't the big man on campus yet.
Yeah, I heard it, not this question, from Andrew Young.
Huh.
They wanted to change the name of Henry Grady High School to Andrew Young High School. And he didn't want to do it because he said that because he made the analogy for Noah, Henry Grady, that...
Right. You once told me this story, yes.
Yeah,
any critiques against him, but for his generation, he was...
For his generation,
right.
what he did for Atlanta...
At that time...
At that time, yeah. Was greater than his, the things that were...
Not so good, not or whatever. So good. Right, yeah.
So,
and you kind of have to know to understand this. I guess you have to know a little bit about Atlanta history, and probably a lot of us are transplants, but... Anyway, for those that get it, they get it. But yeah, that's...
But even those that live here wouldn't know that.
Right, right. All right, good. So that's the first idea. Let's move on to number two. And that is Oh, this is fascinating. Methodology. How to approach having that type of conversation. What's the methodology? So I wrote for number two, methodology equals cultivation. So Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, speaks about two types of energies that each person has both, but people usually have one more dominant than the other. And that is, there's masculine energy and feminine energy. Now, men and women both have both. So men have masculine energy and feminine energy, and women have feminine energy and masculine energy. But what are the energies? Again, Kabbalah speaks more in theories, right? So it's not about a person, it's about a concept. So what's the concept? Masculine energy is the conqueror. It's about conquering, controlling. It's aggressive. It's that's like a masculine approach, if you will, masculine energy. Feminine energy is gentle, cultivating, nurturing, etc. Different types of approaches. And by the way, you see this distinction in energy in many, many different areas. So. For example, and again, it's not drawn specifically along gender lines because each person has a combination of different attributes, both masculine and feminine, as Kabbalah describes in detail with the 10 sefirot attributes. But like one example might be a child, and I'm going to speak somewhat stereotypical with gender roles of, let's say, a father and a mother. So a child will come home or a child will be on the playground and fall and scrape a knee. So one approach, one parent might be, oh, shake it off, get back out there and, rub dirt in it type thing, right? Right. We'll call the Belichick approach. No, I'm kidding. Whatever it is, like more of a tough person approach. That's like the more aggressive, dominating, conquering, like you have a problem, just punch it right back. Someone's saying that nice things to you at school, slug him. By the way, I'm not advocating any of this. I'm just telling you general approaches. The other approach might be, the other parent might say, and sometimes it might be a father saying the first thing and a mother saying this. But the other approach might be a child is crying on the playground, whatever it is. A child fell from the monkey bars. Don't get back out there, whatever. But let me give you a hug. You can cry on my shoulder. Let me take you inside. A more cultivating, nurturing approach. So here's the big idea. How do we influence? Maybe we might think that influence happens. How do you influence? Dominating. With force. How do you change something? With force. That's not what Judaism teaches. It's the feminine approach. It's the feminine method. It's the feminine energy method that creates lasting influence, not the masculine dominating approach that does not create lasting influence, which is why, incredibly, in Kabbalah, the attribute of the 10 attributes that I mentioned, the 10 sefirot, the attribute of leadership, which is malchut, is considered to be a feminine energy because it's the feminine energy approach that creates lasting leadership influence. All right, Howard, please read text number 11 again from a talk of the Rebbe in 1991.
Style of influence has a unique advantage over a man's as a
the approach of Jewish women and girls set an example followed by men.
So in this text, the Rebbe basically says, and the Rebbe does, it seems like he is speaking on along gender lines, but it's not, it's a general distinction that, again, your mileage may vary within each individual, but the point is that the masculine approach of I'm going to influence, I'm going to change the facts on the ground by forcing the change of the facts on the ground, that does not work long term. It works short term, but it doesn't actually influence. A women's the feminine energy approach is what actually works. That's what has a lasting effect and a deeper impact. And so look at that last line. The Rebbe says, the approach of Jewish women and girls sets an example to be followed by the men and the boys. So in other words, it's an unbelievable idea that the preferred energy is one of a nurturing, one of gentle cultivation as opposed to something brash. So when it comes to influence, very, very simply and very, very, very succinctly, when we're thinking about how to say something, how to have a conversation in which we guide, correct, critique, and influence another person, again, think about the husband and the wife in the car, you take a very direct, it's not even like super aggressive, but you take a direct and forceful approach. Here's the problem. The kids are not getting your attention. You got to put away the phone. A very like direct approach like that. Good luck. Good luck. It's not going to influence. You need to use a more feminine energy approach, which is about cultivation, and it's about nurturing, and it's a much more gentle approach. The gentle approach is an approach that works. The aggressive approach does not typically work long term. Make sense? Okay. Next. Number three, third point, is all about awareness. It's all about solution-oriented awareness. And for this, we go back to our good biblical friend, Noah. Noah had a lot of drama in his life. He also lived a very long time. Noah lived for hundreds and hundreds of years. I think he lived for another 600 years. I don't know. He lived like 900 in total. He lived a really long time. So what happens with Noah after he gets off the ark? So he builds the ark. It's waterproof. Thank God for that, right? And the animals survive. He survives. Og survives on the side of the whole thing. Some fish survive. Birds survive. And he rebuilds humanity. And his sons and their wives get off the boat. And they repopulate the earth. Wonderful. What do we know about Noah post-flood? The Torah tells us one story. What? Sorry, say it.
He gets wasted.
He gets wasted. Literally, the Torah says he plants a vineyard, he makes wine, drinks from the wine, gets drunk, takes off his clothes, and becomes debased in the tent. And then the Torah says that his son, Ham, which in here it's the English is Ham, which just evokes so many other things, but Ham, at least in the Hebrew, Ham, one of his sons. Actually, let's read this. Let's literally read this. This is straight up the text. Text number 12. Alan, please read this one, page 170.
Noah started farming and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and came drunk. And he lay naked in his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and he reported this to his two brothers outside. Shem and Japheth took the garment. They placed it on both of their shoulders as they walked backwards. And they covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned backward. They did not see their father's nakedness.
So I want to ask you the question, and this is for everybody. How would you, what is the difference between Ham's approach when he sees his father to the other two brothers, Shem and, I don't even know how to pronounce that. In the Hebrew, it's Yafes. Whatever, Shem and Yafes. How would you characterize the distinction between them?
The first one escalated, the second one resolved the problems.
Right. The first, what does Ham actually do? What does the first one do?
It's like a giggly schoolboy. He's like, hey guys,
dad's drunk again. He's in the tent. His clothes are off. Right? In other words, what does he notice? What is he noticing? What does he see?
Dad's
drunk and naked. But what does he see? He sees the problem. He sees the problem, and maybe he's amused by it, and he wants to get his brothers in on it. but he sees the problem. What about the other two? What about his brothers? What do they see? They see the solution. They're solution-oriented. Oh, dad's drunk. What, I'm going to report it to TMZ? What, I'm going to call up the National Enquirer? What am I going to do here? Yeah, we'll cover father, right? Solution-oriented. There's no judgment. It's not like, oh my gosh, he reported it to his brothers. Look what happened. Look what he's doing. Father's drunk and naked and whatever it is. It's not about the problem. It's not about judgment. It's not about the shame of their father or whatever it is. It's about simply addressing the problem. A good doctor, a good healer, is someone who they see the problem and they diagnose what's wrong, identify it, solve it. Get it fixed. Take care of the other person. Right? Fix the problem. That's a good doctor. Not someone who's like, oh my gosh, who like walks out of the room. Guys, you'll never guess what this patient has. Let's talk about it. That's not a good doctor. Not sensationalism. It's not sensationalism. It's about solving the problem. So a solution-oriented methodology is the way, or solution-oriented awareness is the way to address, is the way to influence in a proper way. Okay, now, I want to point out one other thing. Look in that same text, text number 12. The last verse is so instructive. Look what it says. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. Once again, the Rebbe's insight. The Rebbe asked the question, if it already tells us that their faces were turned backward, so of course they did not see their father's nakedness, why does the Torah have to say it twice? They turned backwards, and they did not see their father's nakedness. And the Rebbe explains, what this means is, it's telling us there were two elements here. Number one, physically, their faces were backwards. And on a deeper level, they did not see their father's nakedness. In other words, that wasn't a big deal to them. It wasn't the dominant thing here. The dominant thing was the solution. They were solution-oriented. They weren't stuck in the problem. If you're stuck in the problem, then you can't solve the problem. And even if you try to solve the problem, the other person is going to feel very resentful that they're being judged and they're being, the whole thing is about the problem. They're being shamed, they're being embarrassed, they're being judged, and that is us now becoming part of the problem. So, when we seek to influence another person, let's recap. Number one, it has to come out of a place of love for the other, not because we're upset or we're embarrassed or whatever it is. It can't be about us, it has to be about them. Number one. Number two, it has to be in a gentle way, with a gentle approach, which we call before the feminine model as opposed to the masculine model. And number three, we ought to be focused on the solution and not get too stuck in the problem. The more stuck we are in the problem, the more we can't get over the problem, the other person is not going to be listening, not going to be influenced. So when we get past the problem, then they can get past the problem as well. Like I said, a good healer doesn't blame the patient. He or she just cares for the other. And a good healer doesn't get stuck in the problem. He or she focuses on the solution, and we need to be good healers. Now, let's move on. Number four. The fourth key here is all about timing. And what this means is to really help someone and to influence someone, to guide someone, to really, really, really offer assistance, or to really assist someone else. The only way to do that is to offer guidance when the person when the problem is not being manifest. Because if it's in the middle of the problem, then they're not going to be open to hearing the solution. So you want to guide someone to a solution to what you consider to be a problem or a challenge for them. And you're not stuck in the problem, you're not focused on the solution, and you're like, okay, this just happened, let me step in and correct it. Wrong time. Here's an analogy. If it's raining outside, and your roof is leaking, and you're thinking, oh, this is not good. It's tripping, right? And your first thought is, I got to get this fixed. You call a roofer, and you tell the roofer, okay, it's raining, and my roof is leaking. I need you out here immediately. What will they tell you? What do they tell you? Yeah. Yeah. I got to wait till it stops raining, and then we can fix it. Why? Now, again, I'm not the builder type. I know it's shocking that I'm telling you this. But apparently, to fix a roof, fix a leak, you have to open it up a little bit more. Is this true? Yes? No? Yes? Yeah? You don't want to do that while it's raining. You're going to make it bigger? Make the hole bigger? Plus, you don't want to slide off the roof. It's got to be dry. You have to have stable footing. So there are many reasons why fixing a roof while it's raining is the wrong time. And again, it's counterintuitive. I'm going to wait for a sunny day when it's not raining and fix my roof. I don't need a roof on a sunny day. Yeah, but that's when you have to fix it. I need it fixed when it's raining, so let me fix it when it's raining. No, that's not the time to fix it. You see what's happening here? Exactly when the problem is being manifest is the wrong time to fix it. And exactly when the problem is not being manifest on the sunny day is when you do need to fix it. The same thing is true when it comes to correcting, critiquing, and influencing others. When the problem, I use air quotes on problem, on the word problem because that's a very judgy word, but when we see the challenge being manifest, that is the wrong time to critique, to try to adjust, and to try to influence. That's the wrong time. Repairing a leaky roof while it's raining is not the right time. You have to wait to a later time when the problem is not being manifest, and then you can have a conversation. Because if you try to have a conversation, like this husband that I keep on pointing back here to where the video screen was and referencing that opening video. If the husband, immediately after that incident, on the ride home, speaks to his wife and says, "Hey, Facebook, we got to get rid of Facebook. It's raining and you're trying to fix the roof. You're making the hole bigger, you're making the problem worse, and you're going to slip off the roof. It's not a good idea. It's not good technique. It's not proper timing." So I have there on the sheet for number 4, timing equals halt. You know what halt stands for? You have it in your books. HALT stands for page 172. Look at 172. Figure 5.3. HALT means hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. If you are hungry, do not say anything to someone else. Okay, you can say something to someone else, like, "Hey, you want to go for dinner?" But you know what I mean. Like, no critique or attempts to influence. If you're angry, we've talked about that already. If you're lonely, if you're tired, this is not the right time. If that's the case, if any of the above or others, and there are many, many other words that we could put in, but halt, I guess, kind of sounds cool, and this is what is being used by professionals today. If it's halt, then halt. Wait. As I say in Yiddish, warte minut, wait a minute, wait more than a minute, wait a bunch of minutes until it's not raining. If it's raining, don't try to fix the roof. It's going to get worse. And no buckets are going to be able to hold the amount of rain that comes in if you try to fix it while it's raining. Wait till it's done. Wait till it's a sunny day. There's no issue. There's no problem. Everything's good. Now you can talk. Now there's a chance that your influence is going to be received in a healthy way. Okay, does it make sense? All right, there is a... Oh, here we go. Text 13. Text 13. Rafael, please read text 13 on page 173. Unbelievable quote from the Talmud.
Just as it is a mitzvah to say the words that will be accepted, it is a mitzvah not to say words if they will not be accepted.
Look at that. You see that? Just like it's a mitzvah to critique someone, because you have to, right? We said before, a human being, you care about your brother and your sister. You have to influence. It's a mitzvah. Rebuke your friend. Make sure there's no anger, but then, correct someone else. There's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah, right? There's also a mitzvah to not say it if it's not going to be effective. There's no mitzvah to make things worse, to make the roof hole, to make the hole in the roof bigger. It's a mitzvah to not say anything, and I want to tell you a story about this. Story goes back over 100 years. Story takes place with the Vishnitzer Rebbe, whose name was Rabbi Yisrael Hager. The story goes that he once approached the home of a very wealthy banker. This fellow was the manager or whatever, the executive of the bank. And this rabbi, and the fellow was Jewish. The rabbi knocks on the door. And the assistant opens up, the attendant of the house, it's a rich, wealthy house, wealthy home, opens up the door. "Oh, rabbi, esteemed rabbi, welcome. I'll get the fellow of the house." He sits down on the couch. The man, the banker, walks in. "Rabbi, it's good to see you. Welcome." Rabbi doesn't say anything. "Can I offer you some food?" Says nothing. Sitting there in stone cold silence. He said I was going to say Steve Austin, but no. In silence, absolute silence. And it's getting very uncomfortable. The rabbi goes back out to where the attendant was somewhere in the back of the house and says, did the rabbi say why he's here? No, nothing. Goes back out. Nothing. Silence. Finally, after a while, he says to the rabbi, why are you here? Can I help? Like, what's going on? You're not saying anything. The rabbi said, I'm not saying anything because the Talmud says there's a mitzvah to not say anything when you know it's not going to help. So I was like, well, what's not going to help? He's like, I can't tell you because it's not going to help. See what's going on here? You with me on this story? The rabbi is telling him, I can't tell you what I want to say because I know it's not going to be effective and therefore I am obligated to not say it because it's going to fall on deaf ears. So now, what do you think the banker wants to know? With every fiber of his being, what the rabbi wants to say. So he begs and he pleads. The rabbi says, no, because you're not going to listen. Finally, he prevails on the rabbi, and the rabbi says, fine. He even, I think in the story, he follows the rabbi back to his house. Like, because the rabbi leaves, he goes home. He says, tell me, please tell me. The rabbi says, okay, here's what's going on. There's a family that's come on hard times, and they cannot pay the loan for their home. And your bank, that you manage or whatever, your bank is about to foreclose and repossess the home. And I want you to stop this from happening. He says, Rabbi, I can't. I don't own the bank. It's not my money. I manage the bank. I don't own the bank. It's not. The rabbi says, you see, that's why I don't want to tell you. Because I knew this is what you were going to say. That's exactly why I didn't tell you. I was right. And he closes the door. The banker now feels terrible. The rabbi really, he worked him. So eventually the story ends that this fellow took his own money, because again, he can't just let go of a loan on behalf of the bank. He took his own money, because he was a wealthy guy, and he paid off the rest of the debt, and the family was able to stay in their home. But again, this is an illustration of when you believe that your words are not going to be effective, halt. Check yourself before you say anything. Check yourself. Is it coming from the right place? Am I using the right methodology? Am I solution-oriented? Am I coming from the right place? Is the other in a place where they can hear what I'm saying? Or is it in the middle of whatever it is, whatever drama is happening? If any of these things are not the way they need to be, don't say it. Wait till another time. Create another time that it would be appropriate, but otherwise, don't say it. The final point is all about technique. That is point number 5. Technique, and we have the three P's over there. Privacy, patience, and praise. So now that we know the proper attitude, the proper awareness, the proper methodology, and the proper timing of influence, now we can learn some very specific teachings in Jewish wisdom about what it means to influence someone else. So for this, we turn to let's see, which text should we do here? We have a few from Maimonides. Let's do text number 14. Text number 14 on page 173. All right. Take it away. Isn't this amazing? Isn't this perfectly appropriate for our discussion? Look how Maimonides kind of encapsulates much of what we talked about in one paragraph here. So, chastise again might seem like a harsh term, but it means critique, try to correct someone else. So, number one, private. Why? Because it's not about calling them out in public. It's not about making a spectacle. It's about influencing, and that is done in a calm, in the right environment. So, number one, in private. The approach should be patience and gentleness. We spoke about the feminine approach versus the masculine approach. And we should inform the other that the only reason that we're doing that, you should specify that you care about them and it's not about you. And again, you don't have to use this terminology specifically about sharing the world to come, but the point is that they should sense that it's all about you. Now, let's continue. Oh, this is amazing. Text 15a and 15b. This is a verse in Mishlei and Proverbs, 15a, and 15b is the Alshich's interpretation. We're going to close with this. This is going to be the final insight that we have. It's an unbelievable teaching. Susan, please read. Text 15a, page 174.
He says to a wicked man, you are righteous. Peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. It is pleasant, however, to those who rebuke the wicked, a good blessing will come upon them.
Okay, so simply, the verses mean, if you tell someone wicked, you are righteous, that's wrong. Don't tell a wicked person you are righteous. But if you rebuke the wicked, that's the right way. Right? So you don't praise the wicked. Someone is doing the wrong thing. You don't praise them. Rather, chastise them. Comes along the Alshich and says, that's not it. That's not it. That's the wrong interpretation. He comes up with this unbelievable interpretation. He doesn't come up with it, but he cites this incredible interpretation. Please continue. 15b. You want to pass? Okay.
Okay. I have heard in the name of the early sages the reason why these two verses are juxtaposed against each other. People curse he who says to a wicked man, you are righteous, because this praise fuels the wicked person's arrogance and causes him to do even greater evil. However, for those who rebuke the wicked in an attempt to lead them back to the path of righteousness, it is pleasant to say to a wicked man, you are righteous. It is pleasant to rebuke another by saying, I don't believe a word of what is being said about you. You are, after all, a wonderful person and an upstanding upbringing. Show everyone just how good you are, so that those who speak badly of you will be ashamed in silence. One who rebukes in this manner, instead of inducing curses and inviting abhorrence, is the recipient of good blessings. I have no doubt that this is the true interpretation of these verses.
So let me read again text 15a in this new light. He who says to a wicked man, you are righteous, peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. It is pleasant, however, for those who rebuke the wicked to say you are righteous. In other words, to just call someone, it's just call someone bad, good, that there's no point. But if you're trying to correct, influence the other, then you can tell them that they are righteous. In other words, you tell them you're better than this behavior. I believe in you. You're a good person. You're a good person. And you can do so much better. And it's not coming from a judgy place. It's coming from caring about the other. This is the true way to influence. And I want to end with a story that I've told many times, but it's a really great story. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky is a phenomenal teacher of Torah. He's also a psychiatrist, and he is the founder of the Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, my hometown. He was also the president of my synagogue, the Chabad synagogue, growing up in Pittsburgh, and he used to deliver a talk every Shabbat, and he was and still is an amazing individual. Rabbi Dr. Tversky, and after the class, remind me, and I'll tell you a story once we're finished with the class about the titles Rabbi Doctor, specifically in that order. Please remind me, it's a funny story. So Rabbi Dr. Tversky shares this, that when he was a child, so it was one Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and there was a guest in his home, and in the afternoon, after services, so the friends, the guest in the house said, Rabbi Tversky was a child then, he said, you want to play chess? He was into chess, he loved chess. So he said, sure, and they played a few games of chess. Later on, his father, Rabbi Dr. Tversky's father, because again, he was a kid, his father said, I heard you play chess. He said, yeah. He says, it's Rosh Hashanah. It's a very spiritual day. Chess is, it's not a bad thing, but it's not. He said to him, it's pasnish. It's not befitting you to play chess on Rosh Hashanah. It's beneath you to play chess on Rosh Hashanah. You're better than that than to play chess on Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Dr. Tversky says this was impactful. Not only did he realize that he shouldn't be playing chess on Rosh Hashanah, on the holiday, but he also was reminded of his own stature, of his greatness, of his nobility, of his potential. And he was reminded that certain things don't fit in with that character. And it wasn't a comment about the other person that had, you know, invited him to play. It wasn't about anyone else, just about him. The message to him was not that you did something wrong, or that you're bad, or that it's the message wasn't focusing on the negative. It was about the positive. It's you are better than that behavior. You can do better. And I want to see you do better because I love you. And that's all it took to get him to realize this lesson, not only about chess and about the value of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, but about his own value and about how to critique and influence others. So, when we love, when it's coming from a place of love and care for the other, when we take a gentle approach, when we make sure that... When we... Hold on, let me try this again. When we do it out of love, when we do it with gentleness, when we focus on the solution and not and don't get stuck on the problem, when we have the right timing, and when we use privacy, patience, and praise, and focus on praising the other as opposed to criticizing the other, then indeed we can have positive results with our influence. Now, we said at the beginning of the class, when we showed the video, that that the fellow, the husband, was listening into the class. Now, let's see if he actually listened and did a good job. I believe, because I want to praise this fellow, I believe that he has the potential to be a fabulous listener. So I think that he is very capable of internalizing and integrating the lessons that we share today.
Awesome.
So with that in mind, let's get this rolling and let's play the video and see how he might approach it differently. And by the way, you might disagree with the exact terminology and the script that they use in the video, but hopefully the core points that we spoke about today will come through. Let's see what we got here. Timing, rain, calm, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, halt, private, yeah, all these good things. Okay, here's the video.
If you recall, Sarah and Benjamin were at a restaurant with the Steins when Sarah got lost in her Facebook.
Sarah? Sarah, are you still there? Oh, Mary, how do you handle her?
Handle what? Oh, the phone thing? That's so not her. Sarah, we've been trying to get your attention. We were discussing our neighbors, Kaylee and Mike. Do you know when they're moving to Arizona?
Oh. Yes, they are moving in April. I didn't realize you guys knew Mike and Kaylee. How do you know them?
Later that evening, after Sarah and Benjamin get home from the restaurant, Benjamin decides to address the Facebook issue.
Sarah, I've been meaning to discuss something with you. Can you spare a minute?
Sure.
I notice how much attention and care you give to the kids, day in, day out. I don't know how you manage so well. They have such a strong bond with you. And that's what makes a happy family.
Thank you. That's so nice of you to say that.
I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, but I'm sure you'll appreciate it just because you're such a caring mother. I noticed that you seem to be concentrating so hard on your phone at times that you don't notice that the kids are trying to speak to you or that they require your intervention.
Oh, I do? Like in the restaurant tonight?
I'm sure many people do that. I have a coworker who does that half the day, but not many people are as devoted as you, so I thought you might want me to point it out.
Thank you. You are right. It's important to avoid the Facebook trap. I'll make an effort when the kids are around. I'm glad you pointed that out.
You're welcome, honey.
That communication was so much more appropriate and effective. Good for you, Benjamin. You've certainly come a long way in just a single lesson.
Once again, the magic of JLI and these classes in the video. So again, remember, influencing somebody is not an automatic. Most of the time, but oftentimes it goes the wrong way and people don't take it the right way and it doesn't have the intended effect. So we need to be very careful to make sure that we're doing it the right way based on some of the ideas that we spoke about tonight. So for homework, this week, check in. Check in on yourself on how and when you critique and guide others. Keep the Jewish tools of influence in mind and your words will be that much more effective. Next week, we have our sixth and final lesson of Communications, Art, and Soul. We talk about how to manage conflict, conflict resolution, through our words and our communication. I look forward to arguing with you about this next week. I'm kidding. Conflict. I'm kidding. Joking. See y'all next week. All right. Oh.